third case, 97-1573, John Kirsten versus Racine Unified School District. And representing John Kirsten is John G. Shannon. Mr. Shannon.
May it please the court, once again, my name is John Shannon, and I represent the plaintiff appellant petitioner John Kirstein. The court may take notice that Mr. Kirstein is present here this afternoon as well. I'll just spend a brief moment going over the facts of the matter, and then I will launch into my argument. Judith and John Kirstein were long-term employees of the Racine Unified School District. Judith was diagnosed with cancer in early 1993. The last day Judith worked was March 19 of 1993 at the Racine Unified School District. Due to an accumulation of sick days, Mrs. Kirstein was entitled to a regular salary through the fall of 1993, even though she was disabled and off of work. Throughout April and June of 1993, the Kirsteins had several meetings with Mike Farrell. Mike Farrell was the Racine Unified School District's special benefits administrator. As such, he was a municipal employee. The Racine Unified School District is a municipal corporation. The meetings between Mr. Farrell and the Kirsteins Farrell consistently maintained that Mrs. Kirstein was ineligible to apply for and receive disability benefits while she was on sick leave. In other words, he indicated that you're going to have to wait until your sick leave is over before you can apply for disability benefits. The statute clearly and unambiguously states that an employee may, in fact, apply for disability benefits while on sick leave. The purpose of the meetings between the Kirsteins and Mr. Farrell was to maximize the benefits Mrs. Kirstein and Mr. Kirstein would be entitled to given Judith's deadly illness and her consequent disability. Mr. Farrell was the recognized expert for the Racine Unified School District employees to seek out advice concerning both their union benefits as well as those administered by the Wisconsin retirement system. Mrs. Kirstein died on June 28, 1993. Her sick days were not exhausted, and on the advice of Mr. Farrell, she did not apply for a disability survivorship annuity. Consequently, John Kirstein was only entitled to a non-annuitant survivor benefit.
Can I interrupt you for just a moment, Mr. Shannon? I want to go back into the facts just a bit more and explore with you Mr. Farrell's status. He was a, quote, benefits specialist. Did he put himself out to the members as being a specialist in benefits, or how was that put out?
Well,
in the record, what will I glean from the record if I start to look through it and say, okay, how did he represent himself, or how did the Unified School District represent him?
The record indicates that he did hold himself out to be the person that the employees would go to for advice.
Did he have a name on the wall or on the door or on his desk or anything like that?
I believe his title was benefits specialist, yes.
He was an employee of the school district?
Yes, he was. Yes.
What was his training?
His training? I believe he was a college graduate and he had a certain amount of training in the Wisconsin retirement system benefits as well as interior training with respect to the union benefits the RUSD employees would be entitled to.
Now, you argue that he would fall within a professional capacity, professional meaning that this was something that we're going to find that there was no immunity. Obviously, that's what, and we would be extending the Scarpassi case, which would then eliminate immunity. I'm just interested, maybe we're jumping ahead, but from a public policy standpoint, I mean, this is not a doctor, lawyer, this is somebody giving advice on pension funds, retirement things. This will basically remove all immunity if you would throw them into a professional category. Is that your understanding of what, if we were to find the way you would like in this case?
That is true. If this court decides to hold Mr. Farrell as a benefits specialist, as a professional, it will extend the Scarpacci doctrine, as you've indicated. And I do believe that with his specialized training, with his specialized background, and his ability to lead the employees and the other people with the Racine Unified School District through the Byzantine and complex laws of Wisconsin retirement system and the union benefits, that he has to be fairly considered to be a quote-unquote professional or expert in these types of
systems. So anytime anyone makes a error, then they would be liable, or the district would be liable.
In the event that their determination is as a professional, be it a lawyer, be it an accountant, be it a benefits specialist, yes. If they make a decision, even though it would be discretionary, it would be entitled professional, and consequently, there would not be immunity.
You make reference to the record indicating specialized background and specialized training in support of your argument that he should be held as a professional and therefore no immunity. What does the record show with regard to specialized background as a benefit specialist? And what does the record show as specialized training as a benefit specialist?
I've put into the appendix, at appendix page 2, or appendix 2, page 58, some of the things that are designated.
I know, I read that. If you're talking about the bulletin for employment, is that what you're referring to? The couple of pages, notice of employment, or whatever it is? Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, I am.
Okay, but my question isn't that. My question isn't what was on the bill for what they were looking for. My question to you is, you advanced that he had specialized background and specialized training. What specialized background does the record show that Mr. Farrell had, and what specialized training as a benefit specialist does the record show that Mr. Farrell had?
Well, once again, Justice Walsh Bradley, I believe the record indicates that he does have specialized training and knowledge in the areas of the Wisconsin retirement system and the union benefits that the Racine Unified School District members would be entitled to.
Good. And what specialized training, that's my question, what specialized training does the record show that he had? Did he take a course on survivorship annuities in the Wisconsin retirement system? My guess is no, and I asked that a bit to push the point. What specialized training, if that's the foundation for your argument that he should be held professional, that he has specialized background and specialized training, what specialized training does he have?
Well, appellant's page 40 indicates, this is the Racine Unified School District memorandum posting the position. And it basically indicates the qualifications are bachelor's degree with at least 2 years experience in human resources.
Does Mr. Farrell have 2 years of experience in human resources prior to his employment in 1991?
I don't know that, Justice Walsh.
Tell me, Mr. Shannon, does it make a difference in this case that the statute was clear on its face? In other words, there was no room for interpretation, as opposed to a hypothetical in which Mr. Farrell may have given erroneous information, but based upon a statute that was not clear on its face, that was subject to interpretation.
I believe that distinction is very important in terms of the ministerial versus discretionary duty distinction, yes. In this particular case, the statute, I don't think there's been an argument posited to the contrary. The statute clearly and unambiguously stands for the proposition that an employee of the Racine Unified School District, or anyone in the Wisconsin retirement system, while on sick leave, may apply for disability benefits. There's no wiggle room, there's no argument factor there. It's clear and concise on its face. So to me, when somebody comes in and posits the argument, or puts forth the query, may we apply for disability benefits while on sick leave, it's very clear that this statutory language indicates that, yes, you can. And consequently, when that knowledge is disputed to a Wisconsin retirement system benefits specialist, there's only one conclusion. That is a clear, precise, and imperative duty to inform the people that, yes, you can apply for disability benefits while on sick leave. With respect to the argument that is it a professional versus governmental distinction, I don't think it makes, I don't think it's quite as clear.
Well, case law says that to have a clear, precise, and absolute duty, there has to be an expression of, find it, it has to be clear as to time, mode, and occasion. Looking at 40.638F, where do you find, if at all, reference to time, mode, and occasion?
Well, I think you have to put this in its proper context, and that is the last meeting that the Kirsteins had with Mr. Farrell was scant days before her death. And when somebody comes in with a terminal illness, absolute knowledge that there's a disability, absolute knowledge that they would be receive these disability benefits, there is the time. The time is right now.
So the negligence you're saying is as of the, was it 22nd of April? When was the, 22nd of June, rather. That's when the negligence occurred in this case?
Well, I believe the negligence occurred throughout the meetings, Justice Walsh Bradley, but when you're asking a question in terms of when would the particular duty be imperative, or when would the time be mandated, that would be the time.
So June 22nd, there was a duty. Was there a duty that was violated when they first met on April 16th?
Yes, I believe there was.
And was the duty at that time clear in mode, occasion, and whatever the third thing is, so as to be absolute?
In my mind, yes, Justice Walsh Bradley. When somebody comes in with a disability, dying of cancer, and says, we have sick days,
isn't it the statute that has to make the duty so absolute and clear? I thought that's...
I don't think the statute is ever going to say the duty to tell people to apply for disability benefits is at the meeting. I think that has to be implied from the circumstances. And the circumstances in this case indicate clearly she came in with this deadly illness. It was going to be a very short period of time until she expired. And I believe from the overall circumstances, at that time there was a clear, precise, imperative duty that the law imposed, not only the time, but the urgency to fulfill the duty, to make the action or give the advice to immediately apply for disability benefits.
What if you hadn't given any advice?
That's a good question. And I think a lot of the cases discuss the fact that there can be discretionary actions. In fact, every human action has some element of discretion, whether or not to have the meeting or not. And I believe that in this case, one could argue that it was discretionary as to whether to even meet with the Kirsteins. But once he met, once he discovered the facts, and once he knew that there was a disability and that she was on sick leave and she wanted advice, and she came to him for this specific advice, then the duty became clear and absolute at that time.
Mr. Shannon, didn't Mr. Farrell refer Kirsteins to the Wisconsin retirement system?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did, Justice.
And apparently they got information then that was very clear, the written information as to the fact that they could apply.
Apparently there is not a dispute that the WRS, Wisconsin Retirement System, sent the Kirsteins a package explaining the benefits in the application process, yes. I believe that issue would go to contributory negligence.
Let me ask you about something that you started out with, and that's tied to this idea that what Mr. Farrell was doing was acting as a professional rather than acting in a governmental capacity, if you will. Where would you draw the line? How would you define professional?
Well, I think, once again, immunity is a judicial balance struck on the one hand between the ability of the public to carry out its functions in an unfettered manner versus the other hand about the rights of an aggrieved person to seek redress. And I think in this situation, what Mr. Farrell was doing was not governmental work, was not the basic policy determinations of the government. He was carrying out more or less administrative functions in a professional format, just like any lawyer who would do work for a municipality, any accountant who does the municipality's books, things like that. He was called upon to serve in this capacity because he was expected to develop a specialized knowledge base.
Well, I guess my concern is, where would you draw the line? Would you say that anyone who is giving advice is now a professional? Or how do you define professional for the purposes that you're arguing for here?
I think I would do it in terms of defining what constitutes a governmental function. And a governmental function, if we look at the Scarpacci decision on page 687, this court recognized the restatement second of torts, and I just think it's right on point versus governmental versus non-governmental discretion or duties, and it
what
states
as
follows.
What page was that? Sorry.
I'm sorry.
Page
687, 96 Wiss second at 687, and it states as follows, and I quote, "It is only when the conduct involves the determination of fundamental governmental policy and is essential to the realization of that policy, and when it requires the exercise of basic policy evaluation, judgment, and expertise that the immunity should have application. The purpose of the immunity is to ensure that courts refuse to pass judgment on policy decisions in the province of coordinate branches of government. If such a policy decision, consciously balancing risks and advantages, took place." I think in this particular case, this was not an essential governmental function. This was not a balancing of risks and advantages. This was simply a negligent failure to advise the Kirsteins in a proper professional manner.
Well, as I understand Carpacci, that was a situation involving an autopsy and involving a medical doctor. And my understanding, at least, is that since Scarpacci, we really have not extended that case, that we've been very careful to limit the case. And it strikes me, at least, and I'd like to hear your response to this, that it's a real leap for us to go from an autopsy situation, a medical doctor, to a situation involving a, quote, benefits specialist. That seems to be something very different in kind, if you will. So I understand where you're going with defining government function, but I wonder if that really takes care of the problem, because you're also tying that to professional. And I'm not so sure that I'm convinced that benefits specialist is a professional within the meaning of the Scarpacci decision.
I guess if I can distill down that question, Justice Crooks, and that is, would the Scarpacci doctrine need to be extended to the facts of this case to rule out immunity? And to answer that question, yes, it would. And I think that in Scarpacci, yes, it was a medical decision, but I don't think that there was anything magical about a medical decision versus a legal decision versus an accounting decision. I think this court at that time focused more upon the professional nature of the decision. And since then, I believe, well, there were two other cases, names escaping me at the moment.
That's one.
What?
Kim's, I think, is one of them.
Well, there were two other cases that discussed the medical exception to the immunity. And in those particular cases, once again, they were medical decisions that were challenged, and the courts, both the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals, ruled that there would be no immunity because they were medical decisions in line with the Scarpacci rationale. But in those cases, once again, they focus on the professional nature versus the governmental function. And I believe that's the linchpin of the Scarpacci decision, if you will. It's not so much the fact that it's a medical decision, and only medical decisions will never be allowed to have immunity. They more or less, you more or less, focused upon the professional nature of the relationship and the decision to extend the immunity exception in Scarpacci. Once again...
Are you finished with that answer?
Just very briefly, Justice, and that was to point out this fact. It indicates, in the Scarpacci, once again on 687, it cited the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals in the case Jackson versus Kelly, and it stated, "We recognize that medical treatment involves judgment and discretion. This does not resolve the matter, however, because medical treatment by a government doctor does not necessarily involve governmental discretion. The type of discretion necessary to immunize official conduct must be governmental, not medical discretion." And I believe that that particular ruling was cited by this court with favor in the Scarpacci decision. Justice Walsh Bradley, did you have a question?
Thank you. In my experience on the trial court, one of the most knowledgeable and sought-after people in the system was the traffic clerk, because she knew all of the Department of Transportation rules. And people would come before me and say, "Judge, you know, how can I get this occupational license? Am I going to lose these points? How do I do it?" And I don't know those answers at all. I mean, it's Byzantine to me. So I'd say, ask the traffic clerk. And because of her training, because of her experience, because I assume the seminars that she went to, she knew these answers. And I assume that at times these answers meant the difference between employment and not being employed, you know, money consequences. Is it your position that the traffic clerk, eminently knowledgeable, giving advice on the effects of the Department of Transportation Motor Vehicle Code, is that person a professional under your definition of professional?
In a word, no.
What's the difference? Assume Mr. Farrell's undergraduate degree was in Phi-Ed. And although the bill that we, when I say bill, I mean the employment notice, said 2 years of human services or human resources experience, and you don't know whether the record shows he has that. We don't know from this record whether or not he has that. Let's see, he had undergraduate in Phi-Ed from La Crosse, then he worked at Mason's Shoes as account executive, and boy, his uncle happened to be working for the Racine Unified System here, and he got the job. Why is he a professional?
Why isn't he a professional?
Why is he? I mean, assume that's his background, and that he learned about the benefit stuff by reading the pamphlets that he got, by going to a few seminars. What differentiates that hypothetical Mr. Farrell that I give you from the all-knowing traffic clerk who also gives advice?
Well, I guess to answer that question, in determining what constitutes a professional for the application of the immunity doctrine, one has to focus not upon who the person is or what, but actually what they're doing. What's their job? What's the reason that their expertise is being sought out? Certainly a person that's a Phi-Ed instructor that goes through the applicable training, acquires the knowledge base to be a benefit specialist, holds that position for several years, and gives advice in a professional manner should be held to a professional standard. Whereas the traffic clerk, basically, not that they're not very important, but they're serving in an administrative capacity and in more or less a governmental capacity, and I believe that person would be entitled to immunity.
Mr. Farrell served for several years in that capacity. Is that facts?
That's my understanding that he was employed in 1991. I can't put
would,
my finger
would it
up.
Make any difference if he was in his first week?
No, I don't believe it would. I think it becomes incumbent not to look at the person's so-called experience level, but frankly, when I was sworn in before this court almost 15 years ago, when that happened, and when I represented my first client, I was a professional. And if I made a mistake at that time, it didn't matter if I was practicing a week or 15 years. The point of the matter is that I would be construed to be a professional at that time. When Mr. Farrell took this job with this specialized knowledge base, and when he deemed it appropriate to sit down with the Kirsteins and administer this professional advice, then he became accountable in a professional format. If I have any time left, I would reserve it for rebuttal.
You do. Well, you have time for rebuttal anyway, and you've got approximately 3.5 to 4 minutes until your red light goes on.
Could I ask one more question?
Sure.
Did Mr. Kirstein get some advice from WRS?
Mr. Kirstein called WRS at one point. To what extent advice was administered, frankly, once again, that would go to contributory negligence, and I don't know to what extent that WRS administered advice to Mr. Kirstein.
I mean, is there some allegation that he got mistaken information, not the pamphlet now, or the printed material, but is there some suggestion that he got mistaken information from WRS?
I'm not aware of that there's been an allegation that the WRS made any type of mistake or misrepresentation. And I would, unless there's another question, I would reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Pollan, representing the Racine Unified School District.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Raymond Pollan, and my clients in this case are the Racine Unified School District, Mike Farrell, and their insurer. If I don't get a chance to say this at any other point in the argument, I'd like to start out by encouraging you to follow the decision that Judge Merrick issued at the trial court. It's a written decision that's part of the record, and also to follow the decision of the Court of Appeals. I believe both of those correctly state the applicable law in Wisconsin. I believe that they are appropriate both in terms of their findings and in terms of the applicable law, and I believe that they should be followed here.
One of the things that bothers me after just sweep away everything in this intricate area of the law of governmental immunity and discretionary and ministerial and quasi-judicial, etc. Here you have an employee benefit, retirement income, sick leave, and I assume that some of the money comes from the employee and some from the employer, is that right?
Well, no, I believe that the employer is the one who makes the payments under the Racine Unified System. Okay. They agree to make payments on behalf of the employee into the state Wisconsin retirement system, which administers it and handles the administration of the benefits.
Okay, it doesn't really matter much whether the employee contributes or not, because part of the salary package is the fringe benefit, and when you take your job, you consider that as part of your pay, and that's part of the quid pro quo. Okay. And the employer also provides services in regard to this package, right?
Some employers do. The Racine Unified School District provided Mr. Farrell, and he was an employee benefits coordinator. Some districts don't. Some, you ask the school secretary, who in some schools is the most powerful person there. But yes, Racine Unified did provide Mr. Farrell to assist in coordinating benefits.
And we're talking about substantial sums of money for the employee. I mean, if the employee takes one benefit versus another, makes a lot of difference.
It
to
can,
the employee.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
And in this case, I think it does.
Right. Now, then you've got the employer hiring somebody, and they, you know, all of us make mistakes. But the usual rule is if you make a mistake and you're negligent, you pay for it, right?
In the context of some employment, that's true. With regard to government, the legislature has created an immunity exception for government for specific reasons that are part of the record, but yes.
But it just, even with the immunity, it just doesn't seem right that you can have a negligent employee costing another employee a load of money and nobody is liable. I mean, it just strikes me that the government ought to be liable. Why can't you say that the government ought to be estopped from claiming that it doesn't have to pay this employee? The government made a mistake. Why doesn't it stand behind the contract, behind the representations made by its employee?
The reason goes to the full underpinnings of why immunity was extended to government employees in the first instance. I mean, this court, in past decisions, has found that police officers, when they err, should be entitled to immunity, that parole agents and CL, when they err, should be entitled to immunity, that school safety directors, in the Kim's case, should be entitled to immunity when they err, college professors, in the Kim's case, people who remove snow, people who remove weeds, that immunity is accorded to governmental entities because, in part, it frees them to make decisions in an appropriate way without worrying that they're going to be sued. It also, I think, is an honest recognition that it's the taxpayers' money. When Horowitz abrogated government immunity, the legislature turned right around in the next session. The Horowitz case said, immunity, based on the common law, is no longer the law. But we tell the legislature, if you'd like to reinstate immunity, if you'd like to put caps on recovery as against governmental entities, if you'd like to create a procedure for claims against governmental entities, you have the opportunity, the power to do that. Boom, in the next session, that's exactly what the legislature did. So does immunity provide the possibility that sometimes people who are injured won't get recovery? Yes, it does. Does the $50,000 cap on claims against governmental entity in some instances limit someone's rights to recovery? Yes, it does. But that has been a decision that has been made to accord government entities the immunity. And if it goes to police officers and the safety director up at UW Stevens Point, it certainly should extend to Mr. Farrell in providing information and counseling to people in the Racine Unified School District.
Seems to me he's more like the medical examiner.
I apologize, ma'am.
I think he's much more like Scarpacci case, whether he's a medical examiner doing a professional job. They could have had an outside consultant, right?
Well, I think I can answer that question because you're right. Not all school districts have employee benefits personnel. Justice Bradley and Justice Babbage both asked what was Mr. Farrell's background to be a professional, and these issues are in the record, and they were specifically addressed by Judge Merrick at the trial court. Judge Merrick, and I'm reading from page 202 of the appendix in my brief. Judge Merrick said, Farrell became employed as the Unified Benefits Specialist in January of 1991. Prior to Farrell's employment with Unified, he had limited involvement in the area of employee benefits. Goes on to discuss specifically about the Wisconsin retirement system, and it says, Farrell had little or no experience in these areas. The job description is what we keep coming back to here. The job description of what that position was a Bachelor of Science degree with some additional experience, perhaps, in the area of insurance. Farrell testified that he had had some prior experience with insurance, but that I believe that he had never worked with a governmental entity before, and he had certainly never worked to advise or administer under the Wisconsin retirement system. And if Mr. Shannon and I don't agree on some things in this case, we both agree that the Wisconsin retirement system statute is Byzantine in how it is administered and in how those benefits come out. I don't know. The money goes in there and somehow the benefits come out. And I think the statutes, there's been some discussion that they're clear on their face. I think they're confusing as heck as to how they are administered and how those calculations are made. And Mr. Farrell provided some advice to the Kirstens. He advised them and specifically answered their questions, but the testimony is also clear that Mr. Farrell was known to the Kirstens as a starting point for this information, a referral point for this information, and he was not going to be the last word for any of the information and any of the decisions they made with the Wisconsin retirement system.
Why is that relevant?
I apologize.
Why is that relevant?
Well, it's relevant because the claim comes to the court on one of negligent misrepresentation. And on a negligent misrepresentation claim, Mr. Farrell may have made statements, but he knew that it wasn't the last word. Mr. Farrell knew that they were going to, he knew that they couldn't make the application for the Wisconsin retirement system through him. He knew that they could go to the WRS, get the application, get the specific paper that told them to apply for the benefits right away. And that the Wisconsin retirement system had a phone system for you to be able to call and ask them questions, and it was something that the Kirstens took advantage of.
Well, Mr. Mullen, let me throw a hypothetical at you just to test this out. Instead of this law, let's assume that we've got a retirement window that's going to be open for only a month. It's going to end on March 31st. So you got to take advantage of it by March 31st or you're out. So somebody comes to see Mr. Farrell and asks about this retirement window. You know, can I get out? And Mr. Farrell says, yeah, you got until April 30th to get out. Gives him a totally wrong answer. The statute says March 31st, he says April 30th. I guess under the law that you are proposing, or under the standard that you're proposing, there is no recourse. Mr. Farrell is immune. Is that correct?
Mr. Farrell is immune under that circumstance unless the law, immunity is provided for government employees' actions unless the exceptions apply. One of the exceptions is the medical decision, the professional standards exception.
No, just take my hypothetical.
Well, and I am, Justice, I apologize if my answer is longer than it need to be, but one of the exceptions that would create liability for Mr. Farrell in that circumstance is if the law specifically created a ministerial duty. Does the law define a specific time, mode, and occasion for operation? Does the law say that Racine Unified, to take your example and take it to my client, does the law require Racine Unified to provide an employee coordinator at all? Does the law then say the employee coordinator has got to answer questions about that system and advise on it? I mean, when the state of Kavanaugh case came before the court and the court looked at the ministerial duty there, the court looked at the statute that says law enforcement agencies shall provide, and the law enforcement agencies shall provide policies.
We don't have that here.
You don't have that here.
And I wouldn't have that here in my hypothetical. I'm trying to make the hypothetical, you know, really sort of brutal. There's no law that says you got to provide it, but they do. They put a guy out that says, he's a benefit specialist. And he gives them the wrong month by, he gives them the wrong retirement date, gives them the wrong window. If nothing else, I think under the rule of law you are espousing, he is immune.
I believe that that's the application of Wisconsin law as it now exists, yes. When government officials err, when the police officer alleged to have erred in the Barilleri case, when the safety director alleged to have erred by not making everything safe up at UW-Stevens Point, there was an injury that occurred and there was no recourse. That's exactly right.
So
immunity implies that there was an error, and immunity assures that recovery can't be pursued against the governmental entity. That's exactly true.
So somebody tells a homeowner you got a destroyed part of your house because it doesn't comply. I may be moving into county, but I don't remember if it covers that. And you destroy the house, and it turns out you didn't have to destroy the house or part thereof. Immunity.
Well, that's a different example again. Now, the Coffee case was a building inspector case where the court made some specific distinctions where a person is applying a specific law. If there's a specific law that is to be applied and there's an error in the application of that, the law or the building inspector provides a specific time, mode, and occasion of operation, and that's violated, there's liability in that circumstance. But if you were to call the building inspector and say, geez, you know, I got all these ants in my house, and I don't know how to get rid of them. And the building inspector says, I don't know any other way to do that other than ripping your house down and starting over again. That's an issue for immunity because there is no time, mode, and occasion for the operation which creates the ministerial duty which provides an exception to the immunity that's available to governmental entities. If I can, I'd like to go back to another question, and if I'm bouncing around a little bit, I apologize. The court ask Mr. Shannon some specific questions about the professional standards that might be applicable in order to trigger the professional standards exception in this case. And I guess I would suggest to this court that there may come a case before this court on which you might decide to extend the professional standards exception beyond medical. But this is not the case. There might be a case where there is a profession that's presented to you. Mr. Shannon referred to accountants, a specific discipline of education, a specific degree, a specific certification in licensure. Lawyers have that same professional standard. Doctors certainly do.
If you go to a university hospital and you have a university professor who's paid by the university and commits malpractice, he's liable, isn't he?
Because the court has decided that the medical decisions are an exception to the regular rule of immunity. You have created that exception. That's right.
Suppose I went to a government lawyer, or government appoints one for me, and he engages in malpractice. So I ultimately have to pay.
Well, that one's a harder one because there's not a privity of contract between the lawyer and the client. But in a general way, and I understand where you're going with that, there's a breach of a professional standard. May that be the case to extend the professional standard exception? It might be. But again, there you've got the law, the legal standard, a specific discipline, a specific standard, taking the bar examination, all of those things tell us that this is a profession. In this Garbacci case, the autopsy had to be performed by a doctor. That was a medical standard necessary. In this instance, there are schools and municipalities all over the state that don't have employee benefits specialists, and liability shouldn't accrue to the municipality just because they provide one. If that was the case, you'd be encouraging municipalities not to provide someone because you create liability in that circumstance where they do. In this case, and the job description provides a desirable candidate for that position, and it's in the record. But the job description isn't a professional standard. It's a BS degree. It doesn't even define a BS in what. It requires a bachelor of science degree. There's no course of study to define. You could be a human resources person. You could be an insurance person. There's no certification. There's not even a requirement in the law that you're required to have one. And if the professional standards exception is going to be extended beyond medical, I would suggest to you that you should look for a profession to point at and identify, and this case doesn't present one to you.
Mr. Pollan, as I understand it, your opponent would answer that by saying, well, let's look at the function that was being performed, whether or not it's a governmental function or not. And he would argue that this, in this particular case, it was not a governmental function. What's your answer to that?
Well, you know, I saw him make reference to that and specifically make reference to the Scarpacci decision, because Scarpacci is interesting in that it talks about the governmental versus non-governmental. But if we go back to the Holitz case says that the immunity based on governmental and proprietary, that's gone. We specifically say that that's not the law anymore. The court has said that again since in Barilleri and in Kim's. We're not looking at governmental versus non-governmental anymore. We're looking at discretionary and ministerial. And with respect to governmental, I've got to say, we've got a government employee here, Mr. Farrell, meeting with two other government employees, Mr. and Mrs. Kirsten, to talk with them about things, including, among other things, a governmental benefits program, the Wisconsin Retirement System. I don't know what sounds more governmental than that.
But isn't the Scarpacci case in part based on a governmental, non-governmental, that is, that this medical is not governmental?
It does discuss it in that way, but the case and the interpretation since then has focused on that as a medical exception and a professional standards exception. It does talk about it in that way, but other cases since then, most recently Kimps and Barilleri, have again reminded us what the court said back in Holitz, which is that governmental and proprietary is a confusing standard that is best left buried before Holitz. And we can point to something that is more easily definable, and that is discretionary versus ministerial. It's more easily definable because ministerial must follow a standard that's defined in the law. And that's something we can point at. That's something for which a court or a judge can get his or her hand on.
What was the last day that Mrs. Kirstein could have applied for these benefits?
The benefits that we're talking about here are annuitant benefits. She would have provided additional benefits to her husband who survived her if at the time she died she had on file an application which sought annuitant benefits. So in theory, if that application had been on file and received by the Wisconsin Retirement System on the date that she died, then she would have been entitled to additional benefits. And that's where you get into the Byzantine nature of the Wisconsin retirement system.
But this is not so Byzantine, is it? I hear you making a concession that this statute leaves nothing to judgment. The statute is not subject to interpretation. There is only one answer to the question that was asked of Mr. Farrell.
Well, Judge Merrick was very clear on talking about that in terms of the standard and what is not clear for any judgment to define the ministerial duty. And here's what Judge Merrick said.
What page?
Oh, boy.
That's okay. Never mind.
I apologize. I don't have the page down. Judge Merrick noted that it is not the application of the law to the information. It's not the application of the law to the application that creates the ministerial duty. A ministerial duty which leaves no room for discretion is created when the law defines a specific mode of conduct for the person, Mr. Farrell.
Let me restate my question.
I apologize if I didn't answer it, sir.
I read the statute, and it seems to me to be clear on its face. Do you concede that this statute is clear on its face, that in fact Mr. Kirstein was eligible, or that in fact Mr. Farrell, if he answered it the way Mr. Kirstein claims, he answered it incorrectly, and the statute leaves nothing to judgment?
I would agree that the statute clearly states that if an application had been on file on the day Mrs. Kirstein died, that Mr. Kirstein would have been entitled to additional benefits. I agree with that, and the statute does specifically say that. But the statute doesn't say, and when you said with regard to the application of judgment, the application doesn't say that Mr. Farrell at all has to advise about the contents of the statute, or when, or how, or anything else.
See, I guess where I'm getting at, and I guess you see where I'm getting at, is, and I think this is the argument made by Mr. Shannon, that the discretionary act on the part of the government employee comes really not in giving the advice, but in deciding whether to give advice.
That was what Judge Merrick decided, yes, sir. And then when he...
Well, once you decide to give advice, then it seems to me that if the statute says March 31st and you say April 30th, it doesn't make much sense to give her immunity.
The decision and the advice that was given is a lot less clear than that, Judge. And I listened to the court's arguments this morning on the sexual predator law, and I was impressed how one word and one phrase made a big difference. And in this case, the words applied for and eligible for are the two important words. Mr. Kirstein and Mrs. Kirstein could have been eligible for these benefits only after they had exhausted all of this other stuff. But they could have applied for it earlier, and had they applied for it earlier, they could have increased the recovery from the system. The question then is whether Mr. Farrell said you can't apply for...
Well, that's where the jury decides, right?
Well, and that's exactly right. But
we have to assume that the question asked was the one that Mr. Kirstein says was asked.
That's right.
And the answer given was the one Mr. Kirstein says was given.
That's exactly right. So, and I just didn't want to let the point go by that we were conceding that Mr. Farrell had said this and advised them totally incorrectly.
We're aware.
The issue was whether it was applied for or whether he was eligible for, and frankly, there are some questions in the record that I would agree may give a jury a reasonable inference one way or the other. We assume that that's what Mr. Kirsten heard at some point, or that's what his wife heard at some point. Yes, sir.
Council 40.63 says if an employer certifies that an employee's date of termination of employment is being extended past the last work day, etc., etc. One of the arguments you advance is, look, 40.63 can't be so clear and absolute because there's nothing in the record to suggest that the employer ever certified the employee's date of termination, because there's nothing in the record to indicate the employee ever was going to terminate or communicated that. But can you explain the import of that argument?
Well, the importance of that argument is probably, as I read the brief last night, I was thinking maybe I made a little bit more of it than I needed to. There are statutes that create ministerial duties. The statute in Kavanaugh that says you shall provide written policies. And I guess I was going with the idea that this statute on argument could create a ministerial duty for an employer because it says the employer has certified, and there's something that points at, ooh, Racine Unified School District, the employer has certified. That's a ministerial duty. And if the issue of this case was, did the employer certify for Mr. Farrell on behalf of Racine Unified, did they certify or did they fail to certify? There's a ministerial duty. If they had failed in that duty, that's something that created a basis for liability. But the only ministerial duty in that whole statute that could be argued comes in that phrase, and the point to put it in the brief was, that's not an issue in this case. The certification issue is not here, since it's the only ministerial duty, and in fact the only duty pointed at in the statute that specifically says this is what the employer has to do, correspondingly this is what Mr. Farrell has to do. Without that, there's nothing in the statute that can create a basis for a ministerial duty, and probably my explanation for that was longer than it needed to be. That's what we're doing on that, and that could have been done a little bit.
Could I ask whether the school district derived any benefit from the alleged negligence of Mr. Farrell?
Not that I'm aware of. Payments are made under the collective bargaining agreement to the state system. The state system administers the benefits and makes payments on the benefits based upon that. I'm not aware of any benefit that accrues to the district one way or the other. And in fact, the lawsuit kind of works the opposite way. The lawsuit seems to suggest that these benefits that are available under the Wisconsin retirement system, if there is an error or if there is just a confusion based upon oral statements as contrast with the written material that they got, that somehow the school district becomes a guarantor of those benefits. The school district has to make up the difference. There's certainly nothing in the law that suggests that. There's nothing in the Wisconsin retirement system rules that suggests that. Nothing in the collective bargaining that would suggest that the district should become a guarantor of those benefits. And I don't know how they would benefit by that one way or the other. I think that they benefit by making sure that they have happy employees who are getting the most of whatever they should be entitled to under the state retirement system. But that's a system administered by the state.
I'm trying to understand why it is that the school district would not try to find some way to deal with this problem. If you acknowledge that the Kirsteins would have been eligible had they filed at an appropriate time, and there seems to be some evidence that they got misleading information, why would the school district not try to make some accommodation?
Because the school district has absolutely no power to do that.
Well,
these benefits are administered by the state, and if there are two misrepresentations alleged in the record. There is a misrepresentation alleged to Mr. Farrell where he said you can't apply for the benefits, and there's a separate misrepresentation alleged to apply to the state, where some unnamed person in a phone conversation with Mr. Kirsten said, you can't apply for the benefit. If there's an error in the administration of those benefits, Chapter 40 provides specific remedies for fixing that if the error is it can't be fixed. And that's something that's right in Chapter 40. It's not like they're without any remedy, but they are not allowed remedy as against Racine Unified. This is not a benefits package administered by them at all. It's not something, if that were true, the district could try to develop sweetheart deals for its employees with the state retirement system. And the state retirement system statutes are very specific to not allow for that. If there are no other questions, that's all that I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Shannon, you can do your rebuttal.
I guess just briefly, with respect to the professional nature of Mr. Farrell's employment position, and that is, if we do look, I was asked several questions about where is it in the record, and I'm finally able to put my finger on it. It is page, Exhibit C, page 40 in my brief. This is the Racine Unified School District posting for the benefits specialist. And the first thing that it says here is up on October 22 of 1990, it says two. In other words, who would be interested in this position? All interested and qualified professional staff. And subject, vacancy, benefits specialist. If we look down at the position purpose, it says to plan, organize, and supervise employee benefit programs in the district, both directly and in cooperation with other administrators. This position reports to the Assistant Superintendent Personnel Services. And it goes on and describes some of the principal responsibilities of the position. Communicate general benefit information to employees. Respond to employees' questions about benefits, claims, problems, etc. Plan and perform retirement counseling for employees. Counseling disabled employees. Evaluating all requests for unemployment compensation benefits to determine eligibility. Represent the district on disputed unemployment compensation claims. Interact with the district workers' compensation insurance carrier regarding accident investigation and safety programs. There are seven or eight more other characteristics that delineate the professional nature of the benefits specialist position, and there it is in the document. The other thing is we were discussing the timing, the mode, and the mandate in the statute for the performance of the specific action. If we look at the decision in Domino and the Cords case, there are a number of cases that we can, and the rulings that we can focus on.
Counsel, but Domino and Cords deal with clear and present danger. They don't deal with breach of ministerial duty because of an absolute clear directive. It's a different exception.
Well, it's a different exception. It's a hybrid exception of the ministerial versus discretionary duty function in this way. That is that when there is a known present danger, the duty becomes clear, absolute, and precise, which is the definition of a ministerial duty. It's not recognized as an exception that stands on its own, as it were. It's recognized more or less of a hybrid of the discretionary versus non-discretionary duty, ministerial versus discretionary duty. And in the Cords case and in the Domino case, what happens is there is a present danger. In Cords, of course, there's the danger of failing to place signs at night in a very dangerous park with a rocky, craggy condition in which a plaintiff was injured. The other case in Domino, a tree fell down in a county in southeastern Wisconsin. The dispatcher was notified of that particular hazardous situation, and she dispatches a squad. While en route, she gets a call of a personal injury accident and reroutes that squad to the personal injury accident, leaving the downed tree with no help, so to speak. And at that point in time, a woman came by, was injured in a motorcycle accident as she hit the tree, and she brought suit against the municipal entity and the dispatcher. And there, in both Cords and in Domino, the mode and method of the performance of the duty was basically looked at in terms of the nature of the situation. In other words, the exigencies of the situation, the emergency of the situation. And it was clear that the duty exists right now to take care of it. And I submit that in this case, when on June 22, she came in, Mr. Farrell's note clearly indicates Judith is dying, wants to know if she's entitled to disability benefits. At that point in time, the duty became exigent, imperative, and absent.
What is the duty? What duty was breached?
The duty in that case was, Mr. Farrell indicates, wants to know if they can apply for disability benefits. And the duty is to advise them, the statute clearly indicates that you can apply for disability benefits while on sick leave.
The duty is to always give correct and right information. I mean, that's the duty. And if it is to your jeopardy, whether it's workman's comp, unemployment compensation, death benefits, that would be the duty for this employee.
Is that your understanding of what the duty is?
That's my understanding of the duty.
Judge Merrick says in response to that, look, this argument is really, that argument that the duty is to give correct information is really an argument that Farrell has a duty to exercise due care and a duty not to be negligent. That, however, is precisely what the doctrine of immunity insulates a party from, liability due to the fact that they have been negligent. How do you respond to Judge Merrick's response of saying, hey, you're just talking about negligence? And, of course, immunity assumes there is negligence.
Yes, I believe in every case, in Domino, in Cords, in the cases where there was found to be an exception to a municipal immunity, the same argument would apply. Of course, there's negligence. Of course, there is negligence in that situation, and it is assumed. The question is, when does the duty arise? If there is a clear, unambiguous statute, shall we say a simple answer to a simple question, the duty becomes imperative at that point in time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, court stands in recess until 9:45 tomorrow.
Please, the red light went on.